I want you to imagine, just for a moment, that you're sitting in a doctor's office.
Oh, yeah. We've all been there.
Right. You're wearing one of those like crinkly paper gowns that never quite closes in the back.
Never. It's a universal rule, I think.
Exactly. And the fluorescent lights are humming overhead, you know, that low sterile frequency. And your doctor, who honestly looks visibly exhausted, is handing you a prescription.
Probably for something chronic, right?
Yeah, let's say it's for a beta blocker to manage high blood pressure, or maybe metformin for type 2 diabetes. So you take that little slip of paper.
And rationally, you know the chemistry works.
Right. You know this pill will force your blood vessels to relax, or it'll force your cells to take up glucose. But as you sit there on that crinkly paper, staring at the prescription, you also know something else.
You know it's not the whole story.
You know with absolute terrifying certainty that this pill does not change the fact that you have to work a 60-hour went just to keep a roof over your head. It doesn't put a grocery store with, you know, fresh, affordable produce in your neighborhood. It doesn't silence the notifications on your phone at 11 p.m.
And it certainly doesn't alleviate that grinding financial stress that's had your stomach in knots for years.
Exactly. You're being handed a purely chemical solution to a problem that was fundamentally created by the exhausting, overwhelming world you're forced to live in.
It is a profoundly isolating experience. And I mean, it happens millions of times a day globally.
It really does.
You're sitting there as an individual holding a tiny biochemical intervention while the actual cause of your illness is civilizational. The illness is treated as a flaw in your personal machinery, rather than a completely logical biological response to an unlivable environment.
That profound disconnect between the pill in your hand and the world outside the clinic door is
Yeah.
the entire focus of what we're plunging into today.
It's a massive topic.
It really is. We are doing a deep dive into a paradigm-shifting framework based on the work of Dr. Bechara Sahailik, specifically his text, Natural Drift and the Future of Medicine.
Which is just a brilliant, dense piece of work.
Oh, completely. It isn't just a critique of healthcare. It is a complete rewiring of evolutionary biology, human history, and like planetary ecology.
Right. Because the core mission here is to understand how our civilizations drift, you know, the specific historical way our society behaves and operates, is quite literally becoming our biology.
Yeah, the premise is that the crisis we are facing with chronic illness isn't a medical failure. It's a civilizational failure showing up in our cells.
And that requires us to abandon the way we usually think about health. I mean, we're trained to view the human body through the lens of the biomedical model.
The machine model, basically.
Exactly. In that model, your body is essentially a very complicated machine. If a part breaks, you take it to a mechanic, the doctor who replaces the part or, you know, adds a chemical to keep the engine running.
And to be fair, I mean, if we're talking about acute trauma, that machine model is spectacular.
Oh, absolutely
Like,
unparalleled.
if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, I don't want a philosopher. I want an orthopedic surgeon with titanium screws.
Right, you want the mechanics then.
Yeah, if I have a life-threatening bacterial infection, give me the strongest antibiotics available. The biomedical model is an absolute miracle when it comes to what this framework calls rescue.
Precisely. Rescue, medicine, trauma care, emergency surgery, resuscitation is one of the greatest achievements in human history. The framework we're discussing today does not dismiss that at all.
But there's a but coming.
A very big one. Here is where the biomedical model hits a brick wall. The exact same mindset that is brilliant at fixing a shattered femur is failing spectacularly when applied to chronic diseases.
Things like mental distress, metabolic dysfunction, autoimmune
Right,
disorders.
and antimicrobial resistance. Because those aren't broken parts, those are systemic adaptations.
And I want to make sure I understand the distinction you're drawing here. Are you saying that applying the broken machine model to something like autoimmune disease actually makes the problem worse?
Well, it blinds us to the cause. The biomedical model operates on the illusion of the isolated body.
The isolated body.
Yeah, it assumes that a disease is just an internal failure of a body that has been temporarily placed in an external context. It completely separates the organism from the world that actually produced the condition.
Oh, I see.
If you have chronic inflammation, the biomedical model says, your immune system is malfunctioning. Let's suppress it. It rarely asks, what is the continuous signal from the outside world that is training your immune system to stay inflamed?
Okay, I keep picturing a team of auto mechanics. They're absolute world-class experts at replacing blown tires and broken suspensions.
Okay, I like this analogy.
So you bring your car in, They fix it in record time and they send you on your way. But they are completely ignoring the fact that the road you have to drive to work on every day has turned into a jagged, crater-filled minefield.
Yes.
So you just keep coming back with blown tires and they keep saying, wow, you really need to take better care of your tires.
That captures the frustration perfectly. But let's push that analogy just a bit further.
Okay, push away.
In the context of human biology, it isn't just that the road is bad and breaking the tires. It's that the tires are actually attempting to change their own shape to survive the craters.
Oh, wow.
And we keep forcing them back into a perfect circle. We shouldn't just be asking, how do we make a stronger tire? The central question here is, what specific manner of living is creating these craters?
And what manner of living must we now conserve so that driving is even possible?
Exactly. We have to look at the road. But the framework suggests that before we can even begin to fix the road, we have to fundamentally rethink how living things exist in their environments.
Which means we have to tear down the standard story of evolution we all learned in high school biology.
We do. And this requires stepping into the work of theoretical biologist Humberto Maturana.
Well, Maturana, right.
His concepts are the bedrock of this entire perspective. Specifically, his concept of natural drift.
Right, because the standard story of evolution, the one that shapes how we view everything from capitalism to medicine, is all about adaptation to a pre-existing environment.
Survival of the fittest.
Yeah. We are taught that there is an environment out there. It poses certain threats or challenges, and organisms randomly mutate. The ones that happen to have the right mutations survive. The environment is the judge. And the organism is the contestant.
Which implies a very one-directional relationship. The environment dictates and the organism adapts.
Right.
Maturana argued that this is fundamentally backwards. He proposed that the organism and its environment do not have a master-servant relationship. They co-arise.
Co-arise. So they drift together, shaping one another continuously.
Yes. To understand that, we need to break down the difference between an environment and a niche.
Because if I use those words in everyday conversation, I mean the exact same thing.
Most people do. But biologically, they are radically different. The distinction is vital.
Okay, break it down for me.
The environment is what an outside observer sees. Let's go back to that doctor's office. If the doctor looks at the patient's chart, they might describe the patient's environment as a specific zip code or a demographic category.
Like an urban center with a certain poverty rate. That's the objective map.
Exactly. That is the objective map. But the organism, the patient, does not live in an abstract map. The patient lives in a niche.
The niche is the actual territory.
Yes. The niche is the lived experience, moment by moment. The environment might be a low-income urban area, but the niche is the specific shelf at the corner bodega, where the only affordable dinner is an ultra-processed frozen meal.
Right. It's the actual things you touch and eat.
It's the exact decibel level of traffic noise outside their specific bedroom window that wakes them up at 3 a.m. every night. The niche is the actual visceral anticipation of eviction when the first of the month approaches.
The organism only interacts with its niche.
Exactly. So the doctor treats the environment as a static label, but the patient's biology is reacting to the niche.
And this brings us to what might be the most counterintuitive concept so far, structural determinism.
Yes, this is a big one.
The premise here is that the outside world, the medium, triggers changes in an organism, but it does not instruct the organism on how to change.
Right.
I struggled with this at first. What is the difference between a trigger and an instruction?
Let's look at it at the cellular level first. Structural determinism means that whatever happens inside a living system happens according to the internal structure of that system at that specific millisecond.
Okay.
An external agent cannot cross the boundary of a cell and micromanage its internal chemistry. A toxin or a virus doesn't hand the cell a blueprint and say, okay, become inflamed now.
It just knocks on the door.
Exactly. The toxin merely perturbs the cell membrane. It's a knock on the door. How the cell reacts to that knock depends entirely on the cell's current metabolic state, its genetic history, its available energy, and its previous exposures.
So if two people are exposed to the exact same cold virus, the virus doesn't instruct both bodies to get sick. The virus triggers both bodies?
Yes, the trigger is the same.
One person's immune structure might neutralize it silently because they slept 8 hours and have adequate vitamin D. The other person's structure, heavily burdened by chronic stress and poor nutrition, mounts a massive fatiguing inflammatory response.
Exactly. The different structures determine the different reactions. The trigger is the perturbation, but the organism's structure specifies the change.
Think about reading a profoundly dense philosophical book.
Okay.
The ink printed on the paper is just the medium. It's just a trigger. The ink doesn't physically force comprehension into your brain.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
The actual aha moment you experience when you read those words depends entirely on your own structure, your prior education, your lived experiences, whether you've experienced grief, even how much coffee you had that morning. The book triggered the thought, but you determined the reaction.
That is a highly accurate way to frame it. But I could anticipate a potential misunderstanding here.
What's that?
If we say the individual organism determines the reaction, it is very easy for a medical system to weaponize that and blame the patient.
Oh, right. It's your fault.
Oh, the stress didn't make you sick. Your flawed internal structure chose to react to the stress poorly. You should just be more resilient. We have to be incredibly careful here.
Yeah, that sounds like a dangerous trap.
It is. Structural determinism is not about moral choice or willpower. It is about biological history. Your structure today is the cumulative physical ledger of every trigger you have ever encountered.
So if a patient's structure reacts poorly to a trigger, it is often because their margins have been stripped away by years of surviving a hostile niche.
Precisely. That is a crucial clarification. The reaction is determined by the biology they were forced to build, not a conscious failure of willpower.
So, if we accept that organisms and niches are locked in this constant dance of triggers and structural responses, what does that mean for natural selection?
It changes the whole picture.
If the environment isn't an external judge picking the winners, how does evolution actually work?
Maturana views natural selection not as a driving mechanism, but as an observer's after-the-fact description.
Like post-game commentary.
Exactly like post-game commentary. The environment didn't actively select the surviving species any more than the terrain selects the water that successfully flows down a mountain.
The water just finds the viable path.
Yes. What truly drives the history of life is conservation. A lineage survives because it manages to continuously conserve a working relationship between its phenotype, its physical body, and behaviors, and its niche.
As long as that organism-niche relationship remains viable, the lineage just drifts along.
That's natural drift. Biology is driven by the conservation of a viable way of living.
But humans throw a massive wrench into this entirely natural process. Because unlike, you know, a finch on the Galapagos Islands or a fern in a rainforest, human beings don't just inherit a niche.
No, we don't.
We artificially build, design, and enforce our own niches using technology, economics, and culture.
Which is where biological drift becomes biocultural drift. And this is what separates us from every other species. We pass down genes, yes, but more importantly, we pass down constructed worlds.
A human child isn't just born into a niche of oxygen, temperature, and caloric availability.
Right.
A human child is born into a niche constructed of language, tax brackets, digital algorithms, gender expectations, and zoning laws.
We are a species that lives in language and emotion. And in this framework, language doesn't just describe the world. It brings the world forth. It generates the categories we live inside.
Wait, elaborate on that. How does language physically alter a biological niche?
Well, think about the invention of the concept of debt.
Okay.
Well, debt is purely linguistic. It doesn't exist in physics or chemistry. You can't put debt in a test tube. But the moment a society creates the linguistic concept of debt and attaches the emotion of fear or obligation to it, it becomes a physical parameter of the human niche.
Oh, wow. I see.
A person in heavy debt experiences chronic cortisol elevation, disrupted sleep architecture, and accelerated cellular aging. A purely linguistic construct triggers a cascade of biological degradation.
Because we stabilize those linguistic concepts into institutions.
Exactly. When human behaviors are repeated and legitimized over generations, they become durable institutions. A hospital, a stock market, a legal system, a standardized testing board. These are all just conserved, stabilized behaviors.
But once they're stabilized, they become the immovable architecture of the niche for the next generation.
Yes. They dictate what is easy to do, what is rewarded with survival, and what is punished with marginalization.
To really grasp how our stabilized behaviors have shaped our literal biology, we need to trace this back.
It's a fascinating history.
The framework takes us on this sweeping walk through the historical eras of human civilizational drift, because every time we changed how we lived, we literally changed the diseases that killed us.
It's a remarkable medical history. The first major epoch is the foraging drift.
So hunter-gatherers.
Right. For the vast majority of our history as a species, we lived in small, mobile groups. The stabilized behavior here conserved deep ecological attention and embedded reciprocity.
You had to be intimately aware of the soil, the migratory patterns, the weather. Your niche was entirely local.
Yes. And medically, the primary threats were acute. Trauma from hunting, exposure to the elements, infant mortality, localized infections.
But chronic stress wasn't really a thing in the same way.
No, because the health logic of the individual was not severed from the land. The nervous system evolved to handle intense, brief spikes of stress like escaping a predator, followed by long periods of social rest and recovery.
But then we undergo the most profound shift in human history, the agricultural drift.
The big pivot.
We domesticate plants and animals. We settle down. We build grain silos.
And we completely alter the organism-niche relationship. Agriculture allowed for caloric surplus, which enabled massive population growth. But the biological cost was staggering.
What do you mean?
The archaeological record shows that early farmers were actually shorter, had worse bone density, and suffered far more joint disease than foragers due to the repetitive, grueling labor.
And it changed the microbial niche entirely, right?
Fundamentally, by living in permanent settlements in close proximity to domesticated animals, pigs, cows, chickens, we created the perfect conditions for zoonotic spillover.
Diseases jumping from animals to humans.
Exactly. Diseases that previously only existed in animals jumped into human populations, creating novel viruses and bacteria that our immune systems had no historical structure to handle. We traded the risk of starvation for the certainty of epidemics.
Which just accelerates as we move into the urban state drift. Now we have thousands of people living in dense cities.
Right. We conserve large-scale coordination, writing, and administration. But we also invent hierarchy, taxation, and organized military force.
And dense urban living without modern plumbing brought massive sanitation burdens.
Oh, massive. We saw the rise of cholera, tuberculosis, and dysentery. We also see the rigid stratification of health. For the first time, your life expectancy is strictly dictated by your class position within the state hierarchy.
The framework then mentions the axial ethical drift, which is interesting because it's not a technological shift, but a philosophical one.
Yes, around the middle of the first millennium BCE, across various civilizations, humanity began to conserve deep reflection on suffering, justice, and the meaning of a good life.
Like the rise of major philosophies and religions.
Exactly. This is vital because it is when medicine shifts from being purely a technical craft-like bone setting to a moral obligation. Healing becomes tied to ethics.
But those ethics were completely sidelined by the next era, the mercantile colonial drift.
Completely. The mercantile colonial drift reorganized the entire planet. It conserved expansion, extraction, commodification, and empire. It created a system where land, raw materials, and human beings were converted into extractable value.
And the biological consequences of this were horrific.
Devastating. It resulted in the rapid global spread of pathogens, decimating indigenous populations who had no structural immunity to European diseases.
Because their structures hadn't co-drifted with those triggers.
Right. It also introduced racialized disease burdens, where the physiological weathering of enslavement and brutal labor became intergenerational biological trauma. It simplified complex ecosystems into monocrop plantations, destroying ecological niches to fuel global trade.
Which sets the stage perfectly for the industrial fossil drift. We discover coal and oil, we mechanize everything, we aim for massive energy throughput.
And this is the era of paradox. Because the industrial fossil drift is what gave us modern biomedicine.
Right.
It gave us the microscope, the sanitary revolution, antibiotics, vaccines, and the ability to synthesize insulin. It doubled human life expectancy by conquering acute, infectious causes of death.
But the paradox is that the exact same machinery that produced those miracles also produced the chronic diseases we are drowning in now.
Precisely. The assembly line didn't just manufacture cars. It manufactured shift work, completely destroying the circadian rhythms that our biology had conserved for millions of years.
Oh, wow.
The industrialization of agriculture gave us abundant calories, but it stripped those calories of micronutrients and flooded our biology with ultra-processed, hyperpalatable foods that our metabolic structures cannot process.
And all the pollution.
Yes. We created an environment thick with petrochemical pollution that continuously triggers our immune systems into states of chronic inflammation.
So we built an incredible system to rescue people from dying quickly, but we built a niche that ensures they will suffer slowly.
That's exactly it.
And that brings us to the present moment, the digital financial drift.
This is the drift we are currently navigating. It conserves extreme abstraction, algorithmic niche making, and the relentless capture of human attention.
Value moves in microseconds.
Right. Financialization dictates the priorities of healthcare systems.
So what does the digital financial drift actually do to the body? I mean, if the industrial drift gave us asthma and metabolic syndrome from pollution and processed food, what is the digital drift giving us?
It is giving us profound nervous system dysregulation. We are witnessing an explosion of anxiety, sleep architecture destruction, and severe loneliness.
It's all psychological, but it becomes physical.
Yes. When your niche requires you to stare at a screen emitting blue light at midnight, scrolling through algorithmically curated triggers of outrage and fear, your biology reacts as if it is under constant existential threat.
It doesn't know it's just Twitter or whatever.
Exactly. The vagus nerve loses its tone. The parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest mode, is rarely fully engaged. We are structurally determining a baseline of hypervigilance.
So if our behaviors guide our drift and our institutions stabilize those behaviors, the logical conclusion is terrifying. Are we literally drifting our species into a completely new physiological baseline?
We are. Our biology is attempting to adapt to a niche that is fundamentally hostile to our evolutionary history.
But the scale of our current drift means we're not just altering human biology.
No, not at all. The digital, financial, and industrial fossil drifts are so powerful that they are actively reorganizing the survival conditions for every other living thing on this planet.
Which introduces the concept of biosphere-anthroposphere unity. I want to spend some time here because it requires us to look at the whole planet.
It's a huge lens to look through.
Right. So the biosphere is the natural world. The anthroposphere is everything we've built. The agriculture, the cities, the supply chains, the underwater fiber optic cables.
It is human civilization materialized. Now, it is very common, especially in systems theory or even corporate literature, to describe the anthroposphere society, the economy, as if it were a living organism.
Like the economy needs to breathe.
Yes, or the city is a living, breathing entity. The framework issues a massive warning against this. It calls it autopoietic inflation.
Autopoietic inflation. Okay, I need you to translate that. What is autopoiesis and why is inflating it dangerous?
Autopoiesis, which translates to self-creation or self-making, is the defining characteristic of a living biological system, like a single cell.
Okay.
A cell maintains its own physical boundary, it metabolizes energy to repair its own components, and it creates the conditions for its own continued existence. Mm-hmm. That is true life. A society, a corporation, or an economy does not do this. A corporation is a network of agreements. It has no biological metabolism.
So why is it dangerous to call a corporation a living organism? It sounds harmless enough as a metaphor.
Because if we pretend the economy is a living organism, we start prioritizing its survival over the survival of actual living beings.
Oh.
We say things like, we must tolerate a certain amount of pollution or human poverty to keep the economy healthy. We sacrifice actual biological life to maintain an abstract, non-living institution. The anthroposphere is not an organism. It is a massive, condition-generating domain.
Mm-hmm.
It is a niche construction machine.
But while it isn't an organism, it is entirely locked together with the biosphere.
Yes, that is the unity concept. You can no longer separate human systems from Earth systems.
Right.
The paper argues that we tend to treat our current planetary crises as separate issues. Over here, we have a climate change crisis. Over there, we have a biodiversity loss crisis. And in this other bucket, we have a zoonotic spillover crisis, like the COVID-19 pandemic.
But they aren't separate.
Not at all. They are all symptoms of a single planetary pathology. They are the completely predictable structural consequences of an extractive civilizational drift.
Give me an example of how they connect.
Well, when you bulldoze a primary forest to plant massive soybean monocultures to feed factory-farmed pigs, you destroy biodiversity. You release stored carbon into the atmosphere, which is climate change, and you force wild bats carrying novel viruses into closer contact with domestic pigs and humans. It is one continuous mechanism of pathology.
And to address this, the medical and scientific communities have proposed the One Health framework. Now, I have to stop you here and push back.
Sure.
Because whenever I hear governments or massive global health organizations talk about One Health, it honestly just sounds like bureaucratic jargon for biosecurity.
It often is used that way.
It sounds like they just want more surveillance, more pathogen sequencing, so they can spot the next bat virus before it shuts down global trade again. Is that really what this framework is advocating?
That is a highly justified critique.
Yeah.
And the author explicitly warns against that exact trap. If One Health is just reduced to defensive biosecurity, if it's just building higher walls and better early warning systems to protect human economic activity from dangerous nature, then it fails completely.
Because it misses the point of natural drift.
Exactly. The framework demands a shift to regenerative One Health.
How does regenerative One Health operate differently than just surveillance?
Surveillance just watches the collapse. Regenerative One Health intervenes in the structure causing the collapse.
So it's proactive.
Very. It acknowledges that human, animal, plant, and ecosystem health are physically metabolically linked. So it doesn't just look for the next virus. It looks at the industrial food systems that are simultaneously causing a global epidemic of metabolic disease in humans, destroying the soil microbiome, and creating immense animal suffering.
Right. It looks at the root.
It looks at how the massive overuse of antibiotics in factory farming is driving antimicrobial resistance that kills people in hospitals. It requires us to redesign the relationships between these systems rather than just bracing for the impact of their failures.
It requires respecting limits. And the framework points out a fascinating psychological hurdle here.
Yes, our cultural resistance to limits.
Exactly. In our modern digital financial world, we view any kind of limit, a regulation, a boundary, an environmental quota, as an attack on our freedom. We are culturally conditioned to believe that endless growth is the only healthy state.
But look at biology. In biological systems, endless, unconstrained growth is the literal definition of cancer.
That's a chilling point.
In biology, limits are not the enemy of life. Constraints are what enable life.
Give me an example of that.
Consider the cell membrane again. A cell only exists as a living entity because it has a strict physical constraint, a boundary that limits what can pass in and out.
Without it, it's just soup.
Exactly. If you remove that constraint in the name of freedom, the cell doesn't become liberated. It disintegrates. Its internal chemistry dilutes into the environment, and it dies.
So planetary boundaries are like that cell membrane.
Yes. Planetary boundaries, like the limits on how much carbon the atmosphere can hold or the minimum threshold of biodiversity required for ecosystem resilience, are the life-enabling constraints of the biosphere. Respecting them isn't a restriction on human flourishing. It is the absolute prerequisite for it.
Okay, this is all incredibly profound on a macro planetary level. The philosophy is beautiful.
Yes.
But I keep thinking about that exhausted doctor we imagined at the beginning with 15 minutes to see a patient. How on earth does a clinician actually use the concept of biosphere-anthroposphere unity when a patient is sitting in front of them complaining of chronic fatigue and elevated blood sugar?
That is the pivotal challenge. How do you operationalize this philosophy in a 15-minute clinical encounter?
Because you can't just lecture them about the anthroposphere.
No. Definitely not. The framework answers this by providing a functional diagnostic grammar called the field of viability. It is designed to move medicine beyond simply listing social determinants of health.
Right, because we hear about social determinants all the time now. A doctor might note that a patient lives in a food desert or experiences poverty or is exposed to poor air quality. But simply applying those labels feels very static.
It is static.
It's like pointing at the pothole but not explaining how it's breaking the axle.
Exactly. Knowing a patient is low income doesn't give the clinician a functional map of how that environment is dynamically altering the patient's biology.
So what does the field of viability do differently?
The field of viability framework gives the clinician 7 specific primitives or operational lenses to map exactly how the patient's niche is constraining their biology.
If our bodies are recording all the civilizational damage, a standard blood panel clearly isn't enough to capture it. What is a doctor supposed to actually look for? Let's go through these 7 primitives deeply because I think this is the most practical, radical shift in the whole text.
I agree. The first primitive is constraints. This is the starting point. It asks, what is limiting this patient's viable action? What are the hard boundaries they cannot cross?
Like a physical constraint.
It could be physiological, like end-stage renal disease. But in this framework, it is equally likely to be structural. Things like profound economic debt, lack of legal status, or living an hour away from the nearest pharmacy without a car.
Right. You cannot prescribe a protocol that requires an organism to operate outside its constraints.
Exactly. The second primitive is margins. Margins refer to the buffers or reserves a system has to absorb shocks. Every living organism requires slack.
So what does the clinician ask here?
They ask what reserves are being depleted. Is the patient chronically losing sleep, meaning their neurological margin is gone? Are their savings completely wiped out, meaning their financial margin for an emergency is zero? Is their pancreatic beta cell capacity exhausted?
And at a planetary level, are we depleting the margin of topsoil?
Exactly. When margins shrink, tiny disturbances become catastrophic. Which brings us to the third primitive, state.
State. That sounds pretty standard.
State is the actual current condition. This is where standard biomedicine usually starts and stops. What is the blood pressure? What is the hemoglobin A1C? What is the subjective feeling of pain?
But in this framework, it's different.
In the field of viability, the state is not a static noun. It is viewed as a single frame in a moving film. It is the current trajectory of the organism-niche relationship.
Okay, fourth is disturbance. And this one seems critical for chronic illness.
It is the driver.
Yeah.
Disturbance asks, what is constantly perturbing the system? What is the recurrent pressure?
So an acute infection would be a disturbance.
Yes, but more often it is chronic. Workplace bullying, the relentless noise of a crowded housing situation, systemic racism, or breathing particulate matter from a nearby highway. When a disturbance is continuous, the body's adaptive response becomes locked in, which leads to pathology.
The fifth primitive is perception, and I found this one absolutely fascinating because it addresses the psychology of medicine itself.
Perception asks, how is the situation being misread, distorted, or ignored by both the patient and the system? This is rampant.
Can you give an example of that?
Sure. A patient might live in a highly toxic, abusive environment, and their nervous system responds entirely appropriately with extreme anxiety and hypervigilance. But the medical system misperceives this natural biological adaptation as a purely individual psychiatric failure.
Oh, man. They prescribe an anti-anxiety medication and tell the patient they have a chemical imbalance.
Completely distorting the reality that the niche is the problem.
It's gaslighting at a biological level.
It truly is. The sixth primitive is regulation. Regulation evaluates how the system or the medical intervention is responding to the disturbance. Does the current response actually restore capacity, or does it merely stabilize the pathology?
Give me a clinical example of stabilizing pathology.
If you have a patient whose high blood pressure is driven by working 3 jobs and sleeping 4 hours a night, and you give them a medication to artificially force their blood pressure down, but you do absolutely nothing to change the labor conditions, your regulation is just stabilizing the pathology.
You've lowered the number on the monitor, but the underlying organism-niche relationship is still degrading. You're just managing the decline.
Perfectly said. And the final primitive is options. Options asks the most pragmatic question. Based on the constraints, the depleted margins, and the ongoing disturbances, what viable pathways are actually open to this patient right now?
Not theoretical, idealized choices, but real, accessible pathways for repair.
Exactly. The framework provides a minimal clinical version of this that completely changed how I view doctor-patient interactions.
Oh, this part is brilliant.
Imagine a physician talking to a diabetic patient whose blood sugar is out of control and who is struggling with their weight. A conventional doctor, using the biomedical model, almost invariably asks, "What did you eat yesterday?" or "Why aren't you following the diet plan?"
Which is immediately perceived as an accusation.
Right. It assumes the patient operates in a vacuum with unlimited choices and simply lacks the moral fortitude to make good ones.
Yes. But a doctor utilizing the field of viability framework asks a completely different question. They ask, when you leave your shift exhausted, what is the easiest, most affordable, and fastest meal available to you before you get home?
It is a profound pivot in the clinical gaze.
It is, because it tests the water of the fish tank instead of blaming the fish. By asking that, the doctor uncovers the constraints, like money and time, the depleted margins, like exhaustion after the shift, the disturbance, which is the built environment of the food desert, and the actual options available.
And in doing so, the clinician stops treating field-constrained behavior as an isolated personal failure. The doctor becomes what the framework calls a viability navigator.
They still prescribe the necessary insulin or metformin, right?
Yes, the rescue medicine is still needed, but they simultaneously protect the patient from the psychological violence of being blamed for a civilizational drift they cannot control.
So we've identified how to map the toxic elements of the fish tank using these 7 variables. We can see the economic constraints and the stress. But here's where we need to get into the deep biology.
The physical embodiment.
Yeah. How exactly do those external societal pressures, a stressful commute, a precarious bank account, a noisy apartment, physically cross the boundary of the skin? How do they enter the body and alter our cellular structure?
That is the mechanism of embodiment. The framework asserts that the body is not a sealed, impermeable object. The body is the physical, biological memory of our drift. Your biography becomes your biology.
It's like the body is a ledger keeping the score of everything civilization is doing to it.
Quite literally. Consider housing. Housing policy is an abstract anthropospheric concept. but housing conditions do not stay outside the body.
They cross the boundary.
Yes. A damp, poorly ventilated apartment embodies itself as respiratory exposure to mold spores, which triggers an immune cascade. The chronic threat of eviction embodies itself as an altered cortisol rhythm.
Meaning your resting heart rate never drops low enough during sleep to clear metabolic waste from your brain.
Exactly. Your job does not stay at the office. It becomes musculoskeletal strain, chronically tight fascia, and systemic inflammation.
And this leads to immune and metabolic drift. You mentioned earlier that the immune system is educated. How does that happen?
The immune system isn't just a static defense force. It is a sensory organ. It is constantly sampling the environment and learning what is safe and what is dangerous.
So if you live in an industrialized niche,
right, breathing fine particulate matter from diesel exhaust, consuming ultra-processed emulsifiers that degrade your gut lining, and experiencing constant socioeconomic stress, your immune system is being educated into a state of chronic alarm.
It learns that the world is fundamentally unsafe.
It begins to misfire, leading to autoimmune conditions where the body attacks its own tissues, or chronic systemic inflammation, which is the root of almost every modern disease, including heart disease and depression.
And metabolic diseases, too.
Yes. Metabolic diseases, like type 2 diabetes or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, are the literal bodily expression of our industrial food systems overriding our evolutionary metabolic capacity.
The framework dives incredibly deep into the cellular level here, specifically focusing on mitochondria. I think most of us remember from eighth grade biology that the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.
Yes, the classic line.
But this framework suggests that description completely misses their true role in chronic illness.
Powerhouse of the cell is a vast oversimplification. Mitochondria do produce ATP, the energy currency of the body. But more importantly, mitochondria are the ultimate environmental sensors.
Sensors?
Yes. They're the executive regulators of adaptive state. They're constantly monitoring the chemical threat level of the cell. Are there toxins present? Is there a viral RNA fragment? Are there stress hormones like cortisol flooding the system?
So what happens when they sense constant, unrelenting disturbance from a toxic niche?
Here is where we can use an analogy. Imagine a nation's manufacturing sector. In peacetime, the factories are producing consumer goods. Let's call that energy, ATP, which the body uses for repair, digestion, and thinking.
Okay, peacetime factories.
But suddenly, the nation is invaded. The government sends an emergency signal, and all those factories immediately stop producing consumer goods and retool to produce ammunition and tanks to fight the war.
That makes a perfect sense for an acute emergency, like an infection.
Right. At the cellular level, this is known as the cell danger response. When the mitochondria sense a severe threat, they intentionally shut down energy production, which is why you feel so profoundly fatigued when you have the flu, and they shift to producing reactive oxygen species.
They produce inflammation.
Yes, they produce inflammation to kill the invader and wall off the damage. It is a brilliant conserved evolutionary defense mechanism.
But what happens when the invader isn't a virus that eventually clears? What if the invader is a toxic work environment, a highly processed diet, and chronic financial panic that never goes away?
The factories never receive the all-clear signal. The mitochondria get stuck, producing ammunition instead of energy. The framework calls this defensive lock-in.
Defensive lock-in.
The organism enters a conserved defensive trajectory and loses the ability to shift back.
Wait, so the profound fatigue that people with chronic illnesses feel, like long COVID or chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia, that isn't just their bodies failing to make energy. It's an active defensive strategy by their cells that got stuck.
Exactly. It is a biological lock-in. The cells are intentionally withholding energy because they believe the organism is under constant attack and needs to hibernate to survive. The tragedy of modern chronic illness is the inability of the organism to return to a state of repair, a process called cellugenesis.
Cellugenesis, the act of creation of health as opposed to just fighting disease.
Yes. Cellugenesis requires a prolonged signal of safety. But our current civilizational drift rarely provides that.
And we see this embodiment happening in the microbiome too, don't we?
Profoundly. The trillions of bacteria in our gut are the most direct interface between the anthroposphere and our internal biology. Microbiome drift is a mirror of civilizational drift.
How so?
The loss of diversity in our gut bacteria is a direct reflection of the loss of biodiversity in our monocrop agriculture. combined with our indiscriminate use of antibiotics and hypersanitation.
And because of the gut-brain axis, those bacteria are literally communicating with our nervous system via the vagus nerve.
Yes. If your microbiome is dysbiotic, if it is starved of fiber and flooded with emulsifiers, it sends stress signals up the vagus nerve to the brain. This alters interoception, which is how you feel inside your own body.
So it changes your literal perception of pain and fatigue.
Exactly. The framework strongly validates that the chronic pain, brain fog, and deep fatigue millions of people experience aren't just in their heads. They are the accurately felt distinctions of a damaged biological field. The body is correctly reporting that the niche is hostile.
I have to pause here because I'm feeling a very specific emotion, and I imagine the listener might be too.
What's up?
I feel immense empathy and validation from this perspective. It makes so much sense. But it also feels incredibly daunting, almost paralyzing.
Because the scale of the problem is so vast.
Exactly. If my cells, my mitochondria, my gut bacteria are literally locked in a defensive state because modern civilization is fundamentally stressful, toxic, and extractive. Doesn't that mean true healing is impossible until we somehow overthrow the entire global economy?
I see where you're going with this.
I mean, how is anyone supposed to get well if the fish tank is fundamentally poisoned? I can't dismantle the digital financial drift by myself.
It is a profound, valid fear. And if the framework ended there, it would be purely nihilistic. But the expert reassurance here is that the goal of this framework, the goal of using the field of viability, is not for an individual doctor or an individual patient to single-handedly fix global capitalism. That is impossible.
So what is the goal?
The goal is to engineer local salutogenic conditions. Salutogenesis doesn't require a utopian world. It requires enough localized safety for the organism's defenses to begin to stand down.
What does a local salutogenic condition look like?
It looks like finding agency within your constraints. Can you, within your specific field, create small pockets of coherence?
Like routines or safe spaces.
Right. Can you establish one predictable, nourishing meal a day to signal metabolic safety? Can you carve out a space to fiercely protect your sleep architecture? Can you find a community, even a small one, that provides relational connection, which powerfully signals safety to the vagus nerve?
It's about sending enough peacetime signals to the mitochondria to convince them to start making tractors again instead of tanks.
Precisely. And crucially, for the medical system, the most powerful local salutogenic intervention a doctor can offer is to stop blaming the patient.
Yes.
When a clinician acknowledges the constraints of the field, when they say, "I see why your body's reacting this way and it makes sense," the blame is removed. Perception is repaired. And that profound psychological validation alone can begin to shift the autonomic nervous system out of defensive lock-in. It restores a margin of dignity.
That is surprisingly hopeful. It's about finding agency and humanity within the constraints, rather than demanding biological perfection from a deeply flawed world. It asks medicine to evolve from just fixing broken parts to actively helping humanity conserve the conditions for life.
Which leads us perfectly into the final section of our deep dive.
The future.
Yes. If we recognize that we are currently caught in a civilizational drift that is making us sick, we have to ask, where do we drift next? Because drift never stops. The author outlines 5 potential future trajectories for our species.
Let's explore these 5 futures. Where might we end up?
The first is the inertial extractive drift. This is simply the path of least resistance. We change nothing.
So business as usual.
Right. We continue to rely on fossil energy. We prioritize endless economic growth. We continue to degrade the biosphere. And we just accept the massive health consequences downstream. In this future, we just keep investing in increasingly expensive high-tech rescue medicine to treat the explosion of chronic and metabolic diseases our extractive economy produces.
That sounds like a slow, exhausting collapse. We just build fancier dialysis machines while the food system gets worse.
Sadly, yes. The second option is the techno-managerial drift.
Techno-managerial, okay.
This is a highly probable future. It acknowledges the crises, but attempts to solve them entirely through massive technological control. It emphasizes ubiquitous biometric surveillance, algorithmic health management, and intense biosecurity.
What does a Tuesday look like in the techno-managerial drift?
Your smartwatch monitors your cortisol and blood glucose in real time, feeding that data to an AI that automatically adjusts your health insurance premiums and orders personalized synthetic meal replacements to be drone delivered to your pod.
Oh, wow.
We use technology to optimize and manage human biology to survive the degraded niche, rather than actually fixing the ecological or social root causes. It's health through optimization and control, not through healing.
It sounds incredibly dystopian, but not as bad as the third option, the fortress fragmentation drift.
This is the darkest path. As climate change accelerates, as supply chains break, and as ecological collapse drives mass migration, societies give in to fear.
They build walls.
They militarize their borders, privatize safety for the wealthy, and completely abandon the vulnerable.
It's global autoimmunity.
Exactly. It is a drift of extreme social autoimmunity, where the system violently attacks itself and actively sheds the most vulnerable populations.
Let's pivot away from that one. The fourth future is what the framework has been building toward, the regenerative one health drift.
This drift represents a conscious turning point. It actively conserves ecological renewal, multi-species health, and public trust. It embraces the biosphere-anthroposphere unity we discussed.
So we actually align with the biosphere.
In this future, we redesign our food systems to regenerate soil microbiomes, which in turn regenerates human metabolic health. We redesign housing and labor laws not just to maximize profit, but to actively support human life capacity and preserve biological margins.
It brings the anthroposphere back into alignment with biological limits. And finally, there is the fifth trajectory, which seems almost spiritual, the metanoic drift. What does metanoic mean in a biological context?
Metanoia is a Greek term that implies a profound, fundamental transformation of heart and mind. The metanoic drift recognizes that good policy and regenerative agriculture are not enough.
We need an internal shift, too.
Yes. It requires a fundamental shift in our emotional and linguistic orientation. It conserves deep intergenerational care, mutual legitimacy, and what Matrona explicitly called the biology of love.
The biology of love? That sounds very poetic for a dense scientific paper.
In Matrona's work, love isn't just a romantic feeling. It is the biological and behavioral dynamic that allows another being to legitimately exist alongside you without trying to control them. A metanoic drift is a civilization that consciously chooses life coherence over extraction. It is the ultimate salutogenic niche.
So as we look at these five potential futures, from the techno-managerial surveillance state to the metanoic drift, what is the specific role of the medical profession? Because this entire framework demands a staggering amount from doctors and nurses.
The concluding proposition of Dr. Sahili's framework is beautiful, and it's a call to action. It states that medicine occupies a completely unique vantage point in society. Medicine is the only institution that literally sees civilization in the body.
It sees civilization in the body. That is a haunting praise.
Think about it. Medicine sees our agricultural policies manifesting as pediatric fatty liver disease. It sees our housing markets manifesting as childhood asthma.
It sees labor conditions manifesting as cardiovascular disease.
Yes, and sleep disruption and physician burnout. Because of this unparalleled intimacy with human suffering, medicine cannot just be a repair shop. Medicine must become the reflective organ of the anthroposphere.
It has to act like the sensory nervous system for society. It has to yell, "Take your hand off the stove."
Precisely. It must be the system that helps humanity see the physical, bodily consequences of the collective choices we are making. It must bear witness to the drift, and it must advocate for life-enabling conditions, not just chemical interventions.
That's a huge responsibility.
It demands fidelity to the immediate, compassionate, physiological care of the patient sitting in front of you, combined with absolute truthfulness about the systemic organism-niche relations that put them in that hospital bed in the first place.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to bring it all the way back to you, the listener. We've covered enormous ground today, from structural determinism to the mitochondria acting as wartime factories to the history of how human epochs literally reshaped our bones and immune system.
It's a lot to process.
It is. But the core truth of this framework is deeply personal. Your biology is the physical memory of the world you are living in.
Every interaction, every chronic stressor, every meal, every environmental exposure, every moment of deep connection is being actively recorded in your immune system, your metabolism, and the epigenetic layer of your cells.
So ask yourself, what kind of world are you writing into your own cells today? What constraints are you living under, and where can you carve out local margins of safety?
And looking at the bigger picture.
Right. If human bodies, 100 years from now, are the direct biological result of the exact manner of living our civilization is choosing to conserve right now, what will those bodies look like?
It is a question that requires us to look far beyond the exam room and look deeply at the world we are building.
Think back to that crinkly paper gown in the doctor's office holding that prescription. The pill might lower your blood pressure today, and you should take it. Rescue medicine is vital. But fixing the road that gave you high blood pressure in the first place, that is going to require all of us to see the drift we are in and fundamentally decide to steer.